A third thing that must be done in order to make the American dream a reality is a very practical thing, but very important. It is necessary to develop an action program to get rid of the vestiges of segregation and discrimination. Now, in order to develop an action program, it is necessary to get rid of one or two false ideas that are disseminated. They are myths, and they are disseminated over and over again. One is the myth of time. And I'm sure that everybody assembled here has heard this idea that only time can solve the problem of racial injustice. And so the individuals who believe this say to the Negro and to his allies in the white community, just be patient, don't push things too fast, be nice, and the problem will work itself out in 100 or 200 years. They say, wait on time. The only answer that we can give to this myth is that time is neutral. It can be used either constructively or destructively. At points, I think the people of ill will in our country have used time much more effectively than the people of goodwill. And it may well be that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the bitter words and violent actions of the bad people who will bomb a church in Birmingham, Alabama, but for the appalling silence of the good people who sit around and say, wait on time. Somewhere along the way of life, we must come to see that human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. And so it is necessary for us to help time and forever realize that the time is always ripe to do right. Now, the other myth that is disseminated is the idea that legislation and judicial decrees and executive orders from the president cannot really solve the problem of racial injustice. Only education and religion can do that. Now, certainly a half-truth is involved here. If the problem is to be solved ultimately, hearts must be changed, and religion and education must play a great role at this point. But it is merely a half-truth. For it may be true that morality cannot be legislated, but behavior can be regulated. It may be true that the law cannot change the heart, but it can restrain the heartless. It may be true that the law cannot make a man love me, but it can keep him from lynching me, and I think that's pretty important also. In other words, through legislation, we control the external effects of bad internal attitudes. And so it is necessary in society to have legislation. And this is why it is urgent for the civil rights bill that is now in the House of Representatives of our nation to be passed. This is a need, and it is a need at this hour. And I feel that people of goodwill all over this nation should write in to congressmen, should write in to senators, letting them know in no uncertain terms that this is a moral issue, and that this bill is needed in order to help the nation rise to its full moral and political maturity. Now, it seems that the bill will get through the House, but then it goes to the Senate. And that is the real danger that the filibuster will be used. And in the midst of the filibuster, behind closed doors, compromises will be made, particularly on the public accommodation section of the bill, and FEPC. I am convinced that if these two sections of the bill are deleted, the bill will be so watered down that it will have no meaning. And this already ugly sore of racial injustice on the body politic of our nation may suddenly turn malignant, and we may be inflicted with an incurable cancer that will totally destroy our political and moral health. And so it is urgent for men of goodwill and women of goodwill all over the nation to work with determination to see that this bill is passed, and that the coalition in Congress, made up of right-wing Northern Republicans and Southern Dixiecrats, will not again serve as the legislative incinerator that will burn to ashes this meaningful civil rights bill. Several months ago, a great, intelligent, vigorous young man stood before the nation, and he said, "The issue of civil rights is not merely a political issue, it is not merely an economic issue. It is at bottom a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and as modern as the Constitution. It is a question of whether you will treat your neighbors as you would like to be treated." And on the heels of that great speech, he presented to the Congress of our nation this comprehensive package of civil rights legislation, the most comprehensive and the strongest civil rights bill ever presented by any president. And since that time, a dark moment has come to our nation. That young man has been assassinated. Now he belongs to the ages. But it is tragic indeed that the question of civil rights is still being debated. And it will be debated in the Senate to the point of a filibuster, probably. And this is tragic indeed, for I am convinced that one of the greatest tributes that the nation can pay to the late President Kennedy is to see that this bill that he recommended to the Congress will pass and pass without being watered down at any point. I would also like to say that there is need for legislation not only on the federal level but also on the local level or within cities and states. The problem of housing discrimination is a glaring reality. All over this country, north and south. And as long as we have this problem, there will be some form of de facto segregation in the public schools and in all other areas of life. And so that is a need for every state to work vigorously for fair housing bills so that we can move out of the long night of housing discrimination. The real test of one's commitment to the brotherhood of man may well be in this housing area, where the men and women can live together as brothers and sisters and not confine the Negro to a ghetto after a ghetto, a ghetto after a ghetto. And so this is a need in every state. There's also a need to grapple with the serious problem of economic, or rather employment, discrimination. The Negro is still at the bottom of the economic ladder. The Negro is still somehow caught and smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society. 42% of the Negro families of our nation still earn less than $2,000 a year, while just 17% of the white families earn less than $2,000 a year. 21% of the Negro families of our nation still earn less than $1,000 a year, while just 5% of the white families earn less than $1,000 a year. 88% of the Negro families of America still earn less than $5,000 a year, while just 58% of the white families earn less than $5,000 a year. Now we can see the social problems created by this. If one does not make an adequate income, he cannot have adequate housing. He cannot have adequate health facilities. He cannot educate his children. And so the problems of juvenile delinquency and the welfare problems and all of the other social problems that develop are only compounded by the failure to grapple with this problem of employment discrimination. And the problem is even more difficult now because of a force known as automation. The Negro has been confined to semi-skilled and unskilled labor, mainly because of a lack of educational opportunities and because of discrimination in apprenticeship training. And now these unskilled and semi-skilled jobs are the ones that are passing away. And so the Negro wakes up and discovers that he's 28% of the population in a city like Detroit, Michigan, and 74% of the unemployed. These problems are growing all over the nation. And the only way that these problems can be dealt with will be through strong, concerted action on the part of people of goodwill, labor, industry, the federal government, and individuals of goodwill must come to see that this is one of the most serious problems of our nation, and a program must be developed at every point to rid our nation of this system. Along with action programs in the legislative area, and certainly there are other things that must be done, many of the civil rights organizations are working with these other things, such as increasing the number of Negro registered voters. We're still working through the courts. This is necessary. But even after working through the courts and even after these other areas, we must see that a court order can only declare rights. It can never totally deliver them. And only when the people themselves begin to act, these rights which are written on paper, given lifeblood. And so this is why nonviolent direct action is necessary to supplement what can be done through these other areas. Now, I would like to take a few minutes to say something about this method or this philosophy of nonviolence, because it has played such a prominent role in our struggle over the last few years, both North and South. First, I should say that I'm still convinced that the most potent weapon available to oppressed people in their struggle for freedom and human dignity is nonviolent resistance. I am convinced that this is a powerful method. It disarms the opponent. It exposes his moral defenses. It weakens his morale, and at the same time, it works on his conscience, and he just doesn't know how to deal with it. If he doesn't beat you, wonderful. If he beats you, you develop the courage of accepting blows without retaliating. If he doesn't put you in jail, wonderful. Nobody with any sense loves to go to jail. But if he puts you in jail, you go in that jail and transform it from a dungeon of shame to a haven of freedom and human dignity. Even if he tries to kill you, you develop the inner conviction that there are some things so precious, some things so dear, some things so eternally true, that they are worth dying for. And in a sense, if an individual has not discovered something that he will die for, he isn't fit to live. This is what the nonviolent discipline says. And that is something about this that disarms the opponent, and he doesn't know how to deal with it. Another thing about this method is that it makes it possible for individuals to struggle to secure moral ends through moral means. One of the great debates of history has been over this whole question of ends and means. There have been those individuals who have argued that the end justifies the means. Sometimes whole systems of government have gone down this path. I think this is one of the great weaknesses and tragedies of communism. It is right here that there's often the attitude that any method, any means can be used to bring about the goal of the classless society. This is where the nonviolent philosophy would break with communism or any other system that argues that the end justifies the means, because in a real sense, the end is pre-existent in the means. The means represent the ideal in the making and the end in process. And somehow in the long run of history, immoral means cannot bring about moral ends. And so the nonviolent philosophy makes it possible for individuals to work to secure moral ends through moral means.